Hello, everyone. This is Pamela Brewer, and today we have two guests, Michael and Cynthia. Theirs is a story about their lives, aptly titled Shockwaves. Why? Theirs is a story about trauma, post-trauma, and survival and recovery. If you believe that this conversation may bring up some issues for you, perhaps you should hold off listening until you have the support you deem necessary for you. Only you can make that decision. I do encourage you to do so. I'm very pleased to welcome Cynthia and Michael Orange. Cynthia is the author of Shockwaves, A Practical Guide to Living with a Loved One's PTSD, that loved one being her spouse, Michael Orange. Cynthia and Michael, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much, Pamela.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting both of us today.
Now, Cynthia, at the beginning of Shockwaves, you say, and I am quoting you, "When I married, I also married Vietnam." What did you mean when you said that? That's quite a stunning commentary.
Well, early in our marriage, I knew that something was amiss. Michael is a combat veteran who served in Vietnam in the Marines. And it took us a long time to realize that the unspoken thing between us was Vietnam, because he was pretty silent, as so many people are, trauma survivors are. He was silent for many years, trying to figure it out himself, why he was feeling the way he was feeling, why he would sometimes withdraw from me and others. And once we came to realize that these were the effects of trauma, and acknowledging the trickle-down aspect of trauma, how it can affect loved ones too, it just Vietnam loomed large in our lives, and has.
It's interesting because you quote the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder in saying that 60% of men and 50% of women experience trauma. And of that, about 8% of men and 20% of women may develop PTSD, which is an anxiety disorder with symptoms that last over 1 month. Michael, as you were coming out of your military service, did anyone talk to you about the psychological effects of what you had experienced?
Golly, that would have been a good idea. You know, I was 19 going into the Marines, and with a strong training as a Catholic, raised a Catholic. In fact, I had spent 4 years in a seminary, high school seminary, thinking about becoming a priest. A very strong moral-based background, and then Marine Corps boot camp is basically designed to upend that. Get you to be able to violate all the basics of thou shalt not kill. There was always the premise that, you know, kill or be killed, the necessity in war. But there is no boot camp to undo that after coming out of war. And in fact, I think the mantra that we used in Vietnam was, it don't mean nothing. So that helped us get through our, I'll say, sins of commission and sins of omission. The problem was is that coming home, especially coming home from Vietnam, when the country was not ready for us, left, blamed us veterans as baby killers, dupes of the military for fighting in an immoral war. The right blamed us for losing the war. So no one was really interested, I don't think, in hearing what the experience was about. Ironically, things have flipped apparently since, I think, we invaded Iraq and Afghanistan after 9/11. And now soldiering veterans, active duty, are to the other extreme of being venerated, I think, which is another mistake. But that's another story. But no, there was no formal training other than sign these papers and get gone.
If I could interject, too, you know, PTSD wasn't a diagnosable condition until 1980. Michael came home in 1970. So I think that entered into it, too. People were still, you know, although as I include in the book, it's not that trauma and the effects of trauma haven't been with us since the days of Greeks, way long time ago in World War One, in World War Two, I think they called it shell shock, and the Civil War. There are accounts of this, but it wasn't recognized as a diagnosable condition until with long-lasting effects. That was the difference, too, that it until 1980.
You know, one of the things that is interesting about what Michael has just said in terms of the attempts to break down the religious training is that even that, I would think, would feel traumatizing because you were very much connected and devoted to your religious beliefs and training, and then you go into something that is sanctioned by your country, by your government, which was essentially telling you that everything that you had just spent 4 years learning and maybe a lifetime believing was all wrong.
You're exactly right. I believe that I've spoken with a lot of veterans suffering from PTSD, and I'm not a therapist. Describe my role as I befriend veterans and help them get the help they need, the professional help they need to deal with PTSD. And what I have found both with myself, my own experience, and with others is that I think the deepest injury is not physical wounds. It's the psychic wounds that are the source for PTSD, and it's moral injury. It's that war demands actions that are antithetical to being human.
And Cynthia, were you going to say something?
No.
You know, it's just so interesting. You're right, Michael, that, you know, on the one hand, we're told that violence is not good, and certainly killing people is a terrible thing. It's okay to have your guns because that's your right as an American, but it's not okay to kill people. So it all just seems, has the potential for being very confusing.
Yes.
Cynthia, you describe dreams that Michael was having and the impact that they had on you and on your daughter. Can you say something about that?
Yes. We did, when I can still remember this vividly, when Michael decided he was going to share with me some of the things about Vietnam back in the early, well, we were married in 73, and this was like 74, and we lived in Kent. Michael was finishing his degree in Kent, Ohio. Yeah, he also graduated from Kent State, so that enters into all of this, too, with the Kent State killings. But we were in Kent, Ohio, and Michael took out his photographs of Vietnam and just in one night just talked about what he had experienced. And he did it so vividly, talked about, you know, children dying and seeing this, and I listened, and I started getting these images, and this isn't, you know, this is something that can happen when you're living with a trauma survivor. You're so concerned about them that you imagine their trauma, and those images can creep into your own dreams. And plus, Michael would have, you know, one of the classic symptoms of PTSD is the startle response and nightmares. And he would awaken, and just if he would have a nightmare about Vietnam, and it was alarming. He'd wake up, and sometimes, or if I inadvertently bumped him or something in the night, that startle response would be so abrupt and alarming, and that affected both of us. And Jessica was small. I mean, but I don't know if you saw her poem that she had written about waking him. Did
yes.
you?
Yes.
Yeah. And
can you describe that to the listeners?
Yes. Our daughter Jessica, when she was in high school, wrote a poem about. Would you like me to read it?
That would be great. Yes.
Okay. Let's see. I've got it. Here it is. A poem in high school, and we went for years thinking that we were shielding her from any of the things that was going on with Michael. Well, we realized years later that children are so astute. They're so aware that there's something going on. And here's what she wrote. It's called Waking Him. Quietly, she calls him, "Daddy, Daddy, are you sleeping?" She has to begin the waking slowly. If she is too sudden, he will uncoil, a fierce spring rusted loose. Gently, she must nudge him back into the world of fenced-in yards and refrigerator art and away from the shadowy echoes of rotten canvas and death. She knows her child hand is not enough because she is in some of those dreams, staggering with him, shoeless through mud. That is all he will say. He tries to protect her from the terror, but she hears the screams at night. She already knows she must use caution in the waking.
It's an astounding poem to write, period. And when you think about the fact that this is a child, it's that much more poignant.
Yes. Yeah, Michael often speaks to different groups. He recently spoke to groups at two colleges, and he still cannot read that poem aloud. Sometimes I'll go with him and read it. It's just so, it takes both of us back to those difficult days.
Michael, I want to ask you about Vietnam Night, when you pulled out the photographs and began talking to your wife as she just described. Can you say a little bit about what that was like for you? It almost sounds like you were there but not there.
Oh, that's exactly right. It was easy. It was methodical. It was a necessary step. I had these things buried in my sea bag, pulled them out. Here are some pictures. You know, here's this, here's that. Here, we did this, we did that. Thank you very much. Put them away. And I think it's emblematic of PTSD. You touch it, and then you bury it. And keep a real tight lid on it. And I didn't necessarily bring it up again consciously, But as Cynthia was saying, clearly, it was the elephant in the room. It was, you know, its effects echo through life, whether you like it or not.
Do you recall what prompted you to bring out the photographs?
Nothing in particular. I think it was, I think I had just said, you know, at some time I will tell you something. I'll tell you some of what I experienced. And I think there's a lesson here where this is significant for Cynthia because it was the first. But for me, it was just a necessary action, but big, because the bigger action was buried. And for your listeners who may want to talk to a veteran with PTSD, this is what you might experience. You'll hear the who, what, when, and where, but not the feelings. No depth. And even it was early in our marriage and we were, you know, I fully trusted Cynthia, but she wasn't there. She's a civilian. And frankly, we can't trust civilians to know.
Cynthia?
Yes. Yeah, it's still difficult for, as you can here.
Yes.
Hard for Michael to talk about this. And he, you know, I think it's very important. And this just isn't for survivors of war. This is for survivors of trauma, all kinds of trauma. I think these symptoms carry over men, women who have experienced any kind of trauma. I think, you know, you can probably speak to that more professionally than we can, but it's been our experience talking with a lot of trauma survivors that it's very common to, as Michael said, touch on it, then bury it. And he successfully buried it. Well, not successfully buried it, but for years he was a type A personality. Many trauma survivors try to escape through drugs and alcohol. Michael's drug of choice was work and compulsive exercise. He attacks everything, yard work, everything, and he still does this with a vengeance. But it's better than using drugs and alcohol, but the workaholism became a real problem in our marriage too, and we kind of limped along like this until he was diagnosed. He wasn't diagnosed with PTSD until 2003. That's 33 years after coming home from Vietnam.
That's extraordinary, and it also speaks, though, to the longevity of the impact of trauma potentially in people's lives. One of the things that I really appreciated about Shockwaves is that in some ways, it really is like a dictionary, if you will, for folks who are experiencing PTSD. As you said, PTSD affects people who have many different kinds of experience. Certainly war is one, but there are wars of many different kinds, aren't there?
There really are. There really are. I interviewed some extraordinary people, survivors of 9/11 and Oklahoma City bombing, and rape survivors, and you know, but you just think of the things that can affect you, accidents and natural disasters, and I think once you become aware of the deep rooted effects of trauma and how it can affect families. I know I knew something was wrong, but it just pushed all my low self-esteem buttons. So I thought I was doing something wrong when Michael was sullen and or buried himself in work or other activities. And I cannot stress enough the importance of getting professional help and support for the trauma survivor and others affected by the your loved one's trauma.
Absolutely. Cynthia and Michael, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue discussing Shockwaves, a practical guide to living with a loved one's PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Folks, will return in just a moment. Wanted to comment on the fact that, you know, this issue of being diagnosed is really kind of a complicated one, because on the one hand, if you have a diagnosis, it in theory then allows several things to happen. It may in fact be services, it may be coverages, it may be medication, it may be lots of things. On the other hand, without a quote-unquote diagnosis, you may not give yourself permission to actually be aware of the feelings that you really have. And so it really is a bit of a dance, because in a lot of ways, only you know whether or not you have been traumatized by fill in the blanks. And what is traumatizing to you may not be traumatizing to somebody else, but it doesn't mean that you haven't been traumatized. So it really gets to be a bit complex.
I think that's so well put. Yes, it was a relief to name it. It was a relief to have, for us to have a diagnosis, because I in the book I liken it to when I got diagnosed with asthma. I have late onset asthma. And I was having symptoms. I was getting out of breath, and I was I couldn't walk as far as I was able to walk before. And I felt this surge of relief when the doctors gave me a pulmonary function test and said, "Yeah, you've got some mild asthma going on." And I thought, "Oh, it's not because I'm feeble and weak and getting older and whatever." And we felt those same things, Michael can speak to this too, but I felt a surge of relief that we could finally name what we hadn't been able to name before. So it was important in that way, but you're very right that you need that diagnosis too to get the medical services and the psychological services and benefits that you need to get.
I'd like to weigh in too. I agree. I was absolutely surprised that, you know, that was the case. Because, like I said earlier, it don't mean nothing was the mantra in Vietnam, and I basically kept that lie alive for 33 years before I began therapy. And there's another aspect. Cynthia writes an awful lot about addiction, and so that's another, say, layer of PTSD as well. There's parallels, I believe, with PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, that the while I am not totally responsible for having the disorder, I am responsible for dealing with it. And for 33 years, I didn't. And that's some of the things I tell to other veterans as well. You may not, you know, be responsible for the PTSD that you're suffering from, but you are responsible, like an alcoholic is responsible for not for the disease, but for getting the for behaviors as, that result from it, and for getting help. And that's part of the message that I had to learn for myself.
And, you know, when you realize that you're dealing with something not of your own creation, but still you are responsible for doing what needs to be done so that you can survive it in a healthy way, initially there's a little bit of pushback because you don't want to. You know, you didn't create it. You don't want to have to fix it. You want somebody else to fix it. And unfortunately, life doesn't work like that.
Doggone it.
I went through 9 months of talk therapy, no drugs, and I found it to be almost as difficult as getting through Vietnam.
I can understand. Because at that point, you were touching on all the feelings, or at least many of the feelings that you were taught in Vietnam that you didn't have.
Yes. And in the same way that linking it to moral injury, and which links back to childhood raising, my therapy was probably one-third dealing with Vietnam and two-thirds dealing with childhood trauma. And that's what I've learned, not only for myself, but for many other vets who have been through therapy, or I think therapy in general. Most therapists, talk therapists, will go back to childhood roots. And I found that actually more difficult in my therapy, because at least there was something, I'll say, manly about dealing with psychic injuries from war. But and part of my not cure, but you know, healing, was to understand what happened to me in Vietnam and what I did in Vietnam, and have compassion for that 2-year-old Marine in Vietnam. But also, even more difficult is to go back and have compassion for childhood trauma that I think was a precursor. Had my therapist said that he likened it to a fractured knee that hadn't healed correctly, and then refractured in Vietnam because it was weak. And that therapy would be to fracture it a third time, but then make sure that the healing was proper. I liked his line. He said, you'll always limp, but you'll walk upright.
You know, when one goes into therapy and realizes, sometimes for the first time, that you're actually human, and that there are so many things that you have experienced that have had such a broad range of impacts on you, effects on you, it can be pretty unnerving. But you survive, and that's the really cool thing in my perhaps biased opinion about therapy.
Well, in the book, I use the example of Kirk Douglas, and how he, when Kirk Douglas had a stroke, I don't know if you remember that, but it left him unable to speak, and he was so despairing. He was a famous actor, and this was his livelihood. His voice was his livelihood. How is he going to be an actor with no voice? And he actually got close to suicide. He loaded a gun. He said he loaded the gun that he had actually used in an old film gunfight at the OK Corral. And when he put the gun inside his mouth intending to pull the trigger, it bumped a sensitive tooth. And that alarming pain caused him to reflexively take the pistol out of his mouth. And what his takeaway from that experience was is that sometimes pain can save your life.
Interesting.
And I think that that just stuck with me as an analogy for getting the help you need, as Michael so beautifully describes it. It's difficult. It's painful. It's painful to go through therapy and touch upon those wounds. But allowing yourself to awaken the feelings you've suppressed for, in his case, decades, is a necessary part of the healing, because feeling the pain saves your life.
Well, and allows you to let it go.
Exactly. And I don't think you ever let it go completely. I don't know about you, but I hate the word closure. How do you feel about the word closure, Pamela? Because it's with you. A friend said it so well. She said, trauma stays with you, but you learn to carry it differently.
Very true. Exactly so. You don't forget it, but you do learn to carry it in a different way, and it doesn't weigh you down the way that it used to when you weren't at a place where you could look at it.
Exactly.
Michael, talk about some of the external triggers that take you to places that perhaps you'd rather not go, even today as we speak.
Well, I would argue it's different post-therapy. Prior to therapy, loud noises, I hate the holidays, the 4th of July are the worst. Fireworks, I just can't stand them. But I can watch war movies. I can watch movies about Vietnam, which may seem ironic, but they help me comprehend my experience as a kid. You know, we were 20 years old over in Vietnam, and how do you grok that experience? And the wisdom of directors like Oliver Stone with Platoon, for example, was very instructive for me to understand that experience. But then again, yeah, that's a trigger. The nightmares are really been a fascinating experience for me. I met Dr. Jeremy Taylor, who did a fascinating book on dreams. And he's a psychologist who has studied this. And I remember his line being something like, all dreams come in service of the dreamer. And so it was really valuable for me during therapy to go to evaluate my dreams, my nightmares especially, and try to understand what they're about. And it's like my psyche was screaming at me to get help. Oh, you know, gouging out eyes isn't going to get your attention. Well, let's do something even more drastic. And oh, that didn't work. Well, here's some more stuff going on, you know, basically screaming at me to get the help I needed. I still don't like, you know, it's all the classic things. Startle response, of course, the crowded spaces and so forth. But it's much less now that post-therapy. And besides that, they're reminders. They're my teachers of this experience. For 33 years, I tried to suppress it. Since then, I've tried to integrate it.
Cynthia, as you were in therapy, you talk about your therapist asking you who was helping you to deal with your war, which was startling for you in a way.
It was, because I went in there thinking, how can I support Michael? He's going through this. I mean, Bill is, he took a medical leave from he was a city planner for a lot of years, and he took a medical leave to do intense therapy. And that was, I mean, we were both kind of living and breathing his therapy. And I found myself so concerned about him that I thought, well, I'll go in, I'll find a therapist and get strategies for supporting him. And that's when she looked at me and she could see that I was getting depressed. I was showing signs of stress. I was showing all these things. And when she said, who's helping you with your war, I really just started sobbing. It's like, you mean I deserve attention? I can, you know, it's okay. It's okay to say out loud that I hate this. Mm-hmm. I just hated, you know, I got to just hate Vietnam and what it does, or war, or what trauma does to so many people. But I didn't know what to do with those feelings because I had to have someone give me permission to say, I need help too, and I deserve attention.
And what about Jessica during this time? How were the two of you guided to talk to or work with Jessica?
Well, we weren't, you know, throughout this, when Michael got the diagnosis, 2003, Jessica was at that point in college, and we did talk about it, and she saw a counselor too, but I don't feel comfortable talking about her experience.
Sure.
Because she's not involved in this conversation.
Sure.
But we made sure that we told her that this is, you know, we both felt horrible that we didn't recognize these things sooner. And we had, I mean, she had a secure childhood, and we always took great pains to make sure she knew that she was safe, she was loved, she was secure. But I wish I had realized sooner. I think we both wish that.
Yes.
And because, you know, she was prone to anxiety, and you don't have the knowledge or tools to connect those dots. But once we recognized how this, you know, how it was affecting me, we always opened the door and encouraged her to get support.
Well, you know, so often adults don't realize that children are impacted by what's going on in the house. That's just such a common household experience. And, you know, the younger the child is, the more likely the adults are to assume that the child is actually kind of clueless. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Cynthia and Michael Orange as we continue our conversation about Shockwaves, a practical guide to living with a loved one's post-traumatic stress disorder. Don't go away. Cynthia and Michael, at one point in the book, you begin to talk about the grief that occurs, grieving the loss of self, grieving the changes in the relationship. And then you begin to talk about ways to heal and to care for yourself. But I'd like for both of you to talk about the changed relationship as you began to go through your therapeutic process.
Speaking for myself, I would describe our marriage and relationship as better than ever. This experience has brought us closer, but that's not to say that trauma is good. Boy, everyone should have it in their marriage, because that's not what I'm saying. But the tools that we gain through therapy, open communication, acknowledging feelings, me being aware and more sensitive to not only Michael's PTSD reactions. 4th of July, I don't put pressure on him to go see fireworks, and we communicate more honestly. Our relationship has shifted and changed and deepened significantly. And I think it's mostly for me, I think it's because of the open communication and I have such an enormous respect and deep love for this man. And Michael,
The PTSD is a form of depression, and prior to therapy, I had, say, two extremes of either emotional numbing to the point where I was emotionally not very connected to my life, say, or to emotionally to Jessica and Cynthia as much as I could have been. That's part of the numbing side of PTSD, and that can be followed periodically, two or three times a year. I'd have the opposite emotional flooding, and I would have just what I call my crashes, and I would just be a blithering, sobbing 9-year-old boy crying until I didn't have any tears left. These kinds of extremes. And that's the that's the spouse I was for a long time, which is not good. With therapy, I was able to bring it into balance. And in some ways, life is harder because I am in touch with my emotions. I can easily cry. I can be joyously happy. I can be far more emotionally bonded with Cynthia and Jessica. We have two incredible grandsons now, and the bonds are just unbelievable. And I don't think I would have been able to experience this without healing. Secondly, I'm a very fortunate man. Not only did I have a good, solid upbringing, and even with the traumatic experiences in Vietnam, a fantastic life, and sharing that with Cynthia, and sharing Vietnam with her, placing that burden on her for our 44 years together, and she has been a saint in dealing with me. And I feel bad for anyone who doesn't have the phenomenal support system I have. I think that's absolutely essential for my healing process. I burdened Cynthia with a 9-month therapy, and basically, as she said, we just lived it together. And Vietnam is still part of our daily daily lives somehow. And we still, but it brings us closer.
Oh, it sounds like, first of all, it sounds like Cynthia is a keeper.
Well, that's on my good days.
Fair enough.
Let's not go overboard here. There were...
So we'll say mostly a keeper.
Mostly. Okay. As is Michael.
but it also sounds like, Michael, what you're describing is a life that's more alive, that's more human. And that's a gift.
Yes. It's more genuine.
Yes.
I'm a more genuine person. I'm not denying Vietnam. I'm not suppressing it. I've integrated it.
And I'm glad you mentioned the losses. I think it's so important to acknowledge for any family who has gone through any kind of trauma, to be honest about the losses, because your relationship does shift and change, and mm-hmm. and I describe grief is an emotion that flushes us, it flushes out and makes room inside for healing. And so I think it's important to say, yeah, this happened, and we have suffered loss, but it's okay. You know, things can get back in balance. I describe a family as a wind chime, that when a wind chime is hung wrong, it doesn't have that sweet chiming. But when you put it into balance, you know, it can be a lovely thing. But it takes work.
Cynthia, you talk about green grief. What is that?
Green grief?
Yeah.
Yes, that was a phrase that came to me when I had I co-facilitate a caregivers group, and early on in it, I had a friend, Rhonda, who died from a brain tumor, and she taught me about the greenness of things, even in the darkest of times. This brain tumor affected the way she saw things, and I would go visit her, and and the outside, it was a dreary day. It was just dreary, but she was seeing green. She looked out that window, and everything is green. And it got me to think about grief in that way, that there is, even in loss and grief, there are those, that greenness of hope, that there's always something to cling to that hopefully can get people through those dark times. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does indeed. One of the things that we often hear, that I often hear when it comes to trauma and therapy, is the theory that, well, it's already happened, and what good is talking going to do? And what you and I, what we have all been talking about today is the value of talking. Can you, either one of you, just say a bit more about the importance of reaching out and talking to professionals and non-professionals, people who can be supportive as you go through your work?
I'll go first, and then Michael can supplement. I find that it's important for both people, as we've touched upon, to find a base of support. But I also want to caution people not to force trauma survivors to talk before they're ready.
Good point.
Or to play therapist when they're not prepared or don't have tools. I think it's important for them to do their homework and find out where those sources of support are, and you can direct them. When Michael had his crash, thank goodness I had resources available and this instinct to not be upset, to think that I called another veteran I knew who was getting help for PTSD, and he was the one who helped Michael immediately. And sometimes you have to step back and say, okay, he needs to talk to someone, and right now it might not be me. And I can't, and I tried not to be hurt by that, but realized that I wasn't there. I'm not a war veteran, and he might have to talk to a war veteran right now or someone who has gotten help for his own similar issues. And I would think that would be true for rape survivors, for survivors of other trauma. So I think it's important to be a attentive listening presence, but be very cautious about that. And I know I like that you started this conversation by telling listeners, if you're not ready to hear some of the things that we're going to be talking about trauma, to beware of that, and gave them that kind of disclaimer. Michael, would you?
Yes, I wanted to go in the same direction, not being a therapist either. And though I do listen to many veterans' stories, and I'm glad Cynthia keeps bringing up broadening the range of what her book covers, trauma from all kinds of sources, not just war. But the role that I see myself in as a befriender is a listening presence, and to be non-judgmental, and to both give the message that the therapy works, and there's not just talk therapy. There's a full range of therapies available to deal with PTSD, and resources are available from government to VA, private therapists, and that the person really is responsible for dealing with these issues, and they need the help is available, and they should get it. In the meantime, yes, I try to listen with an open heart, and that's why I bring up the word over and over again, non-judgmental. If for someone who hasn't gone through that experience, you can't really know what it's about. So you listen with compassion.
Michael, do you ever find, as you're listening to the stories of others, that you are feeling re-traumatized yourself?
Oh, yes. Yes, it's very hard.
What do you do?
I have my tools. First of all is my wife, Cynthia.
Okay.
I don't suppress. I admit. It's part of Vietnam has one of the major things in my life that's made me who I am. So, for better or worse, I accept that.
We have a wonderful support network of friends and family. Our daughter and her husband have been terrific, and when they really have been supportive of Michael talking to college students, and veterans, and doing the service work he does in that realm of his life, and they're very conscious of it. And so often they'll know that he will have been speaking, and they'll check in with him.
Yeah.
How you doing? How you know? And that just having those touchstones,
yes,
I think is very important, and they do that for both of us. They've come to realize the effects of trauma, and are so supportive and so present. And I think that's important, that support network, the importance of a support network, I don't think can be stressed enough. There's also, your listeners might want to know that there is the center, the National Center for PTSD. If they go and just Google that on the internet, there's a wealth of information available that covers the signs of PTSD, the resources available, offers help for families. And we talked about children. There's another, there's a booklet available for free to download for helping children who have experienced trauma, but it also is very relevant for helping children cope with parents who have, you could,
sure.
It's immediately transferable, and the National Institute of Mental Health puts that out, and it's called Helping Children Cope with Violence and Disasters, and it's a free download booklet, so they might also be interested in that.
And their website is nami.org, and they are a wonderful resource as well. Cynthia Orange and Michael Orange, I want to thank both of you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk and for discussing shockwaves. And as you've both said, this is a practical guide to living with a loved one's PTSD, regardless of whether it has to do with war or sexual assault trauma or physical violence trauma or trauma of any kind. This is really an excellent resource, Shockwaves by Cynthia Orange. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you, Pamela.
Thanks.
Alrighty, you take care. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. All programs there are archived under the day in which they air. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk, so do send me an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's mindtalk.org. You can also download the free Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or the Google Play Store. And just a reminder, if it's unacceptable, you take care.